flat 9mm pistol, a leather sap, and his razor-edged filleting knife under his shirt. An elastic bandage held the weapons against his flat belly. His sport coat would button over them. A cloth soaked in chloroform and sealed in a plastic bag was in his coat pocket. In his hand, he carried a new guitar case. Three pay telephones stand near the subway exit in the center of Eastern Parkway. One of the telephones has been ripped out. One of the others works. Dollarhide fed it quarters until Reba said, "Hello?" He could hear darkroom noises over her voice. "Hello, Reba," he said. "Hey, Dee. How are you feeling?" Traffic passing on both sides made it hard for him to hear. "Okay. Sounds like you're at a payphone. I thought you were homesick." "I want to talk to you later." "Okay. Call me late, all right?" "I need to see you." "I want you to see me, but I can't tonight. I have to work. Will you call me?"
"Yeah, if nothing..."
"Excuse me?"
"I'll call."
"I do want you to come soon, Dee."
"Yeah. Goodbye, Reba." "All right."
Fear trickled from his breastbone to his belly. He squeezed it and crossed the street. Entrance to the Brooklyn Museum on Tuesdays is through a single door on the extreme right. Dollarhide went in behind four art students. The students piled their knapsacks and satchels against the wall and got out their passes. The guard behind the desk checked them. He came to Dollarhide.
"You have an appointment?"
Dollarhide nodded.
"Painting study, Miss Harper."
"Sign the register, please." The guard offered a pen. Dollarhide had his own pen ready. He signed Paul Crane. The guard dialed an upstairs extension. Dollarhide turned his back to the desk and studied Robert Blum's Vintage Festival over the entrance while the guard confirmed his appointment. From the corner of his eye, he could see one more security guard in the lobby. Yes, that was the one with the gun.
"Back of the lobby by the shop, there's a bench next to the main elevators," the desk officer said. "Wait there. Miss Harper's coming down for you."
He handed Dollarhide a pink-on-white plastic badge.
"Okay if I leave my guitar here?"
"I'll keep an eye on it."
The museum was different with the lights turned down. There was twilight among the great glass cases. Dollarhide waited on the bench for 3 minutes before Miss Harper got off the public elevator.
"Mr. Crane, I'm Paula Harper."
She was younger than she had sounded on the telephone when he called from St. Louis. A sensible-looking woman, severely pretty. She wore her blouse and skirt like a uniform.
"You called about the Blake watercolor?" she said.
"Let's go upstairs, and I'll show it to you. We'll take the staff elevator. This way." She led him past the dark museum shop and through a small room lined with primitive weapons. He looked around fast to keep his bearings. In the corner of the Americas section was a corridor which led to the small elevator. Miss Harper pushed the button. She hugged her elbows and waited. The clear blue eyes fell on the pass, pink on white, clipped to Dollarhide's lapel.
"That's a sixth-floor pass he gave you," she said. "It doesn't matter. There aren't any guards on 5 today. What kind of research are you doing?"
Dollarhide had made it on smiles and nods until now.
"A paper on Butts," he said.
"On Thomas Butts?" He nodded. "I've never read much on him. You only see him in footnotes as a patron of Blake's. Is he interesting?"
"I'm just beginning. I'll have to go to England."
"I think the National Gallery has 2 watercolors he did for Butts. Have you seen them yet?"
"Not yet."
"Better write ahead of time." He nodded. The elevator came. 5th floor. He was tingling a little, but he had blood in his arms and legs. Soon, it would be just yes or no. If it went wrong, He wouldn't let them take him. She led him down the corridor of American portraits. This wasn't the way he came before. He could tell where he was. It was all right. But something waited in the corridor for him, and when he saw it, he stopped dead still. Paula Harper realized he wasn't following and turned around. He was rigid before a niche in the wall of portraits. She came back to him and saw what he was staring at. "That's a Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington," she said. "No, it wasn't. You see, a similar one on the dollar bill. They call it a Lansdowne portrait because Stuart did one for the Marquis of Lansdowne to thank him for his support in the American Revolution." "Are you all right, Mr. Crane?" Tollerhide was pale. This was worse than all the dollar bills he had ever seen. Washington, with his hooded eyes and bad false teeth, stared out of the frame. My God, he looked like grandmother. Tollerhide felt like a child with a rubber knife. "Mr. Crane, are you okay?" "Answer, or blow it all. Get past this." "My God, man, that's so sweet." "You're the dirtiest." "No." "Say something." "I'm taking cobalt," he said. "Would you like to sit down for a few minutes?" There was a faint medicinal smell about him. "No. Go ahead. I'm coming." "And you are not going to cut me, grandmother. God damn you. I'd kill you if you weren't already dead. Already dead. Already dead. Grandmother was already dead. Dead now. Dead for always." "My God, man, that's so sweet." The other wasn't dead, though, and Dollarhide knew it. He followed Miss Harper through thickets of fear. They went through double doors into the painting, study, and storage department. Dollarhide looked around quickly. It was a long, peaceful room, well-lighted and filled with carousel racks of draped paintings. A row of small office cubicles was partitioned off along the wall. The door to the cubicle on the far end was ajar, and he heard typing. He saw no one but Paula Harper. She took him to a counter-height work table and brought him a stool. "Wait here. I'll bring the painting to you." She disappeared behind the racks. Dollarhide undid a button at his belly. Miss Harper was coming. She carried a flat black case, no bigger than a briefcase. It was in there. How did she have the strength to carry the picture? He had never thought of it as flat. He had seen the dimensions in the catalogs, 17 1/8 by 13 1/2 inches. But he had paid no attention to them. He expected it to be immense, but it was small. It was small, and it was here, in a quiet room. He had never realized how much strength the dragon drew from the old house in the orchard. Miss Harper was saying something. "Have to keep it in this Solander box, because light will fade it. That's why it's not on display very often." She put the case on the table and unclasped it. A noise at the double doors. "Excuse me, I have to get the door for Julio." She refastened the case and carried it with her to the glass doors. A man with a wheeled dolly waited outside. She held the doors open while he rolled it in. "Over here, okay?" "Yes, thank you, Julio." The man went out. Here came Miss Harper with the Solander box. "I'm sorry, Mr. Crane. Julio's dusting today and getting the tarnish off some frames." She opened the case and took out a white cardboard folder. "You understand that you aren't allowed to touch it. I'll display it for you. That's the rule, okay?" Dollarhide nodded. He couldn't speak. She opened the folder and removed the covering plastic sheet and mat. There it was.
the great red dragon, and the woman clothed with the sun, the man-dragon rampant over the prostrate pleading woman caught in a coil of his tail. It was small, all right, but it was powerful, stunning. The best reproductions didn't do justice to the details and the colors. Dollarhide saw it clear, saw it all in an instant. Blake's handwriting on the borders, two brown spots at the right edge of the paper. It seized him hard. It was too much. The colors were so much stronger. Look at the woman wrapped in the dragon's tail. Look! He saw that her hair was the exact color of Reba McLean's. He saw that he was 20 feet from the door. He held in voices.
"I hope I didn't shock you," said Reba McLean.
"It appears that he used chalk as well as watercolor," Paula Harper was saying. She stood at an angle so that she could see what he was doing. Her eyes never left the painting. Dollarhide put his hand inside his shirt. Somewhere a telephone was ringing. The typing stopped. A woman stuck her head out of the far cubicle.
"Paula, telephone for you. It's your mother."
Miss Harper did not turn her head. Her eyes never left Dollarhide or the painting.
"Would you take a message?" she said. "Tell her I'll call her back."
The woman disappeared into the office. In a moment, the typing started again. Dollarhide couldn't hold it anymore. Play for it all, right now. But the dragon moved first. "I've never seen..."
"What?"
Miss Harper's eyes were wide.
"A rat that big," Dollarhide said, pointing. "Climbing that frame."
Miss Harper was turning.
"Where?"
The blackjack slid out of his shirt. With his wrist, more than his arm, he tapped the back of her skull. She sagged as Dollarhide grabbed a handful of her blouse and clapped the chloroform rag over her face. She made a high sound once, not over loud, and went limp. He eased her to the floor between the table and the rack of paintings, pulled the folder with the watercolor to the floor, and squatted over her. Rustling, wadding, hoarse breathing, and a telephone ringing. The woman came out of the far office.
"Paula?"
She looked around the room.
"It's your mother,"
she called.
"She needs to talk to you now."
She walked behind the table.
"I'll take care of the visitor if you..."
She saw them then. Paula Harper on the floor, her hair across her face, and squatting over her, his pistol in his hand, Dollarhide stuffing the last bite of the watercolor in his mouth, rising, chewing, running toward her. She ran for her office, slammed the flimsy door, grabbed at the phone, and knocked it to the floor, scrambled for it on her hands and knees, and tried to dial on the busy line as her door caved in. The lighted dial burst in bright colors at the impact behind her ear. The receiver fell quacking to the floor. Dollarhide, in the staff elevator, watched the indicator lights blink down, his gun held flat across his stomach, covered by his books. First floor. Out into the deserted galleries. He walked fast, his running shoes whispering on the terrazzo. A wrong turn, and he was passing the whale masks, the great mask of Sisuit. Losing seconds, running now into the presence of the Haida high totems, and lost. He ran to the totems, looked left, saw the primitive edged weapons, and knew where he was. He peered around the corner at the lobby. The desk officer stood at the bulletin board, 30 feet from the reception desk. The armed guard was closer to the door. His holster creaked as he bent to rub a spot on the toe of his shoe. "If they fight, drop him first." Dollarhide put the gun under his belt and buttoned his coat over it. He walked across the lobby, unclipping his pass.
The desk officer turned when he heard the footsteps.
"Thank you," Dollarhide said.
He held up his pass by the edges, then dropped it on the desk. The guard nodded.
"Would you put it through the slot there, please?"
The reception desk telephone rang. The pass was hard to pick up off the glass top. The telephone rang again.
"Hurry."
Dollarhide got hold of the pass, dropped it through the slot. He picked up his guitar case from the pile of knapsacks. The guard was coming to the telephone. Out the door now, walking fast for the botanical gardens, he was ready to turn and fire if he heard pursuit. Inside the gardens and to the left, Dollarhide ducked into a space between a small shed and a hedge. He opened the guitar case and dumped out a tennis racket, a tennis ball, a towel, a folded grocery sack, and a big bunch of leafy celery. Buttons flew as he tore off his coat and shirt in one move and stepped out of his trousers. Underneath, he wore a Brooklyn College T-shirt and warm-up pants. He stuffed his books and clothing into the grocery bag, then the weapons. The celery stuck out the top. He wiped the handle and clasps of the case and shoved it under the hedge. Cutting across the gardens now toward Prospect Park, the towel around his neck, he came out onto Empire Boulevard. Joggers were ahead of him. As he followed the joggers into the park, the first police cruisers screamed past. None of the joggers paid any attention to them. Neither did Dollarhide. He alternated jogging and walking, carrying his grocery bag and racket and bouncing his tennis ball, a man cooling off from a hard workout who had stopped by the store on the way home. He made himself slow down. He shouldn't run on a full stomach. He could choose his pace now.
He could choose anything.
Chapter 42. Crawford sat in the back row of the jury box eating redskin peanuts, while Graham closed the courtroom blinds.
"You'll have the profile for me later this afternoon, I take it," Crawford said. "You told me Tuesday. This is Tuesday."
"I'll finish it. I want to watch this first." Graham opened the express envelope from Byron Metcalf and dumped out the contents. Two dusty rolls of homemade film, each in a plastic sandwich bag.
"Is Metcalf pressing charges against Niles Jacoby?"
"Not for theft. He'll probably inherit anyway, he and Jacoby's brother," Graham said. "On the hash, I don't know. Birmingham DA is inclined to break his chops."
"Good," Crawford said.
The movie screen swung down from the courtroom ceiling to face the jury box, an arrangement which made it easy to show jurors filmed evidence. Graham threaded the projector.
"On checking the newsstands where the Tooth Fairy could have gotten a tattler so fast, I've had reports back from Cincinnati, Detroit, and a bunch from Chicago," Crawford said. "Various weirdos to run down."
Graham started the film. It was a fishing movie. The Jacoby children hunkered on the bank of a pond with cane poles and bobbers. Graham tried not to think of them in their small boxes in the ground. He tried to think of them just fishing. The girl's cork bobbed and disappeared. She had a bite. Crawford crackled his peanut sack.
"Indianapolis is dragging ass on questioning newsies and checking the Servco Supreme stations," he said.
"Do you want to watch this or what?" Graham said.
Crawford was silent until the end of the 2-minute film. "Terrific. She caught a perch," he said. "Now, the profile..."
"Jack, you were in Birmingham right after it happened. I didn't get there for a month. You saw the house while it was still their house."
"I didn't. It was stripped and remodeled when I got there. Now, for Christ's sake, let me look at these people, and then I'll finish the profile."
He started the second film. A birthday party appeared on the screen in the courtroom. The Jacobys were seated around a dining table. They were singing.
Graham lip-read, "Happy birthday to you."
11-year-old Donald Jacoby faced the camera. He was seated at the end of the table with the cake in front of him. The candles reflected in his glasses. Around the corner of the table, his brother and sister were side by side, watching him as he blew out the candles. Graham shifted in his seat. Mrs. Jacoby leaned over, her dark hair swinging, to catch the cat and dump it off the table. Now Mrs. Jacoby brought a large envelope to her son. A long ribbon trailed from it. Donald Jacoby opened the envelope and took out a big birthday card. He looked up at the camera and turned the card around. It said, "Happy birthday, follow the ribbon." Bouncing progress as the camera followed the procession to the kitchen. A door there, fastened with a hook. Down the basement stairs, Donald first, then the others, following the ribbon down the steps. The end of the ribbon was tied around the handlebars of a 10-speed bicycle. Graham wondered why they hadn't given him the bike outdoors. A jumpy cut to the next scene, and his question was answered. Outdoors now, and clearly it had been raining hard. Water stood in the yard. The house looked different. Realtor Guillen had changed the color when he did it over after the murders. The outside basement door opened, and Mr. Jacoby emerged carrying the bicycle. This was the first view of him in the movie. A breeze lifted the hair combed across his bald spot. He set the bicycle ceremoniously on the ground. The film ended with Donald's cautious first ride.
"Sad damn thing," Crawford said. "But we already knew that."
Graham started the birthday film over. Crawford shook his head and began to read something from his briefcase with the aid of a penlight. On the screen, Mr. Jacoby brought the bicycle out of the basement. The basement door swung closed behind him. A padlock hung from it. Graham froze the frame.
There. That's what he wanted the bolt cutter for, Jack, to cut that padlock and go in through the basement. Why didn't he go in that way?
Crawford clicked off his penlight and looked over his glasses at the screen.
"What's that?"
"I know he had a bolt cutter. He used it to trim that branch out of his way when he was watching from the woods. Why didn't he use it and go in through the basement door?"
"He couldn't."
With a small crocodile smile, Crawford waited. He loved to catch people in assumptions.
"Did he try? Did he mark it up? I never even saw that door. Guillen had put in a steel one with deadbolts by the time I got there."
Crawford opened his jaws.
"You assume Guillen put it in. Guillen didn't put it in. The steel door was there when they were killed. Jacoby must have put it in. He was a Detroit guy. He'd favor deadbolts."
"When did Jacoby put it in?"
"I don't know. Obviously it was after the kid's birthday. When was that? It'll be in the autopsy if you've got it here."
"His birthday was April 14th, a Monday," Graham said, staring at the screen, his chin in his hand. "I want to know when Jacoby changed the door." Crawford's scalp wrinkled. It smoothed out again as he saw the point.
"You think the Tooth Fairy cased the Jacoby house while the old door with the padlock was still there," he said.
"He brought a bolt cutter, didn't he? How do you break in some place with a bolt cutter?" Graham said.
"You cut padlocks, bars, or chain. Jacoby didn't have any bars or chained gates, did he?"
"No."
"Then he went there expecting a padlock. A bolt cutter's fairly heavy, and it's long. He was moving in daylight, and from where he parked, he had to hike a long way to the Jacoby house. For all he knew, he might be coming back in one hell of a hurry if something went wrong. He wouldn't have carried a bolt cutter unless he knew he'd need it. He was expecting a padlock."
You figure he cased the place before Jacoby changed the door, then he shows up to kill them, waits in the woods.
You can't see this side of the house from the woods.
Crawford nodded. He waits in the woods. They go to bed, and he moves in with his bolt cutter and finds the new door with the deadbolts.
Say he finds the new door. He had it all worked out, and now this,
Graham said, throwing up his hands.
He's really pissed off, frustrated. He's hot to get in there. So he does a fast, loud pry job on the patio door. It was messy the way he went in. He woke Jacoby up and had to blow him away on the stairs. That's not like the dragon. He's not messy that way. He's careful, and he leaves nothing behind. He did a neat job at the Leedses going in.
Okay, all right, Crawford said. If we find out when Jacoby changed his door, maybe we'll establish the interval between when he cased it and when he killed them. The minimum time that elapsed, anyway. That seems like a useful thing to know. Maybe it'll match some interval the Birmingham Convention and Visitors Bureau could show us. We can check car rentals again. This time we'll do vans, too. I'll have a word with the Birmingham field office.
Crawford's word must have been emphatic. In 40 minutes flat, a Birmingham FBI agent, with Realtor Guillen in tow, was shouting to a carpenter working in the rafters of a new house. The carpenter's information was relayed in a radio patch to Chicago.
"Last week in April," Crawford said, putting down the telephone. "That's when they put in the new door. My God, that's 2 months before the Jacobies were hit. Why would he case it 2 months in advance?"
"I don't know. But I promise you, he saw Mrs. Jacoby or saw the whole family before he checked out their house. Unless he followed them down there from Detroit, he spotted Mrs. Jacoby sometime between April 10, when they moved to Birmingham, and the end of April, when the door was changed. Sometime in that period, he was in Birmingham.
The Bureau's going on with it down there?"
"Cops, too," Crawford said.
"Tell me this. How did he know there was an inside door from the basement into the house? You couldn't count on that, not in the South."
"He saw the inside of the house, no question."
"Has your buddy Metcalf got the Jacoby bank statements?"
"I'm sure he does."
"Let's see what service calls they paid for between April 10 and the end of the month. I know the service calls have been checked for a couple of weeks back from the killings, but maybe we aren't looking back far enough. Same for the Leedses."
"We always figured he looked around inside the Leeds house," Graham said. "From the alley, he couldn't have seen the glass in the kitchen door. There's a latticed porch back there. But he was ready with his glass cutter, and they didn't have any service calls for 3 months before they were killed."
"If he's casing this far ahead, maybe we didn't check back far enough. We will now. At the Leedses, though, when he was in the alley reading meters behind the Leeds house 2 days before he killed them, maybe he saw them going in the house. He could have looked in there while the porch door was open."
"No, the doors don't line up. Remember? Look here." Graham threaded the projector with the Leeds home movie. The Leeds' gray Scotty perked up his ears and ran to the kitchen door. Valerie Leeds and the children came in carrying groceries. Through the kitchen door, nothing but lattice was visible.
"All right. You want to get Byron Metcalf busy on the bank statement for April? Any kind of service call or purchase that a door-to-door salesman might handle. No, I'll do that while you wind up the profile. Have you got Metcalf's number?"
Seeing the Leedses preoccupied Graham, absently he told Crawford 3 numbers for Byron Metcalf. He ran the films again while Crawford used the phone in the jury room. The Leedses film first. There was the Leedses dog. It wore no collar, and the neighborhood was full of dogs. But the dragon knew which dog was theirs.
Here was Valerie Leeds. The sight of her tugged at Graham. There was the door behind her, vulnerable with its big glass pane. Her children played on the courtroom screen. Graham had never felt as close to the Jacobys as he did to the Leedses. Their movie disturbed him now. It bothered him that he had thought of the Jacobys as chalk marks on a bloody floor. There were the Jacoby children, ranged around the corner of the table, the birthday candles flickering on their faces. For a flash, Graham saw the blob of candle wax on the Jacobys' bedside table, the bloodstains around the corner of the bedroom at the Leedses. Something... Crawford was coming back. Metcalf said to ask you, don't talk to me. Crawford wasn't offended. He waited stock still, and his little eyes grew narrow and bright. The film ran on, its light and shadows playing over Graham's face. There was the Jacoby's cat. The dragon knew it was the Jacoby's cat. There was the inside basement door. There was the outside basement door with its padlock. The dragon had brought a bolt cutter. The film ended. Finally, it came off the reel, and the end flapped around and around. Everything the dragon needed to know was on the two films. They hadn't been shown in public. There wasn't any film club, film fest. Graham looked at the familiar green box the Leeds movie came in. Their name and address were on it. And Gateway Film Laboratory, St. Louis, Missouri, 63102. His mind retrieved St. Louis, just as it would retrieve any telephone number he had ever seen. What about St. Louis? It was one of the places where the Tatler was available on Monday night, the same day it was printed, the day before Lowndes was abducted. Oh, me, Graham said. Oh, Jesus. He clamped his hands on the sides of his head to keep the thought from getting away. Do you still have Metcalf on the phone? Crawford handed him the receiver. Byron, it's Graham. Listen, do those reels of Jacoby film you sent, were they in any containers? Sure. I know you would have sent them along. I need help bad on something. Do you have the Jacoby bank statements there? Okay, I want to know where they got movie film developed. Probably a store sent it off for them. If there are any checks to pharmacies or camera stores, we can find out where they did business. It's urgent, Byron. I'll tell you about it first chance. Birmingham FBI will start now checking the stores. If you find something, shoot it straight to them, then to us. Will you do that? Great. What? No, I will not introduce you to Hot Lips. Birmingham FBI agents checked 4 camera stores before they found the one where the Jacobys traded. The manager said all customers' film was sent to one place for processing. Crawford had watched the films 12 times before Birmingham called back. He took the message. Curiously formal, he held out his hand to Graham. It's Gateway, he said. Chapter 43. Crawford was stirring an Alka-Seltzer in a plastic glass when the stewardess's voice came over the 727's public address system. Passenger Crawford, please. When he waved from his aisle seat, she came aft to him. Mr. Crawford, would you go to the cockpit, please? Crawford was gone for 4 minutes. He slid back into the seat beside Graham. Tooth Fairy was in New York today. Graham winced, and his teeth clicked together. No, he just tapped a couple of women on the head at the Brooklyn Museum. And listen to this. He ate a painting. Ate it. The art squad in New York snapped to it when they found out what he ate. They got 2 partial prints off the plastic pass he used, and they flashed them down to Price a little while ago.
When Price put them together on the screen, he rang the cherries. No ID, but it's the same thumb that was on the Leeds kid's eye.
New York, Graham said.
Means nothing. He was in New York today. He could still work at Gateway. If he does, he was off the job today. Makes it easier.
What did he eat?
It was a thing called The Great Red Dragon and the Woman Clothed with the Sun. William Blake drew it, they said.
What about the women?
He's got a sweet touch with the sap. Younger one's just at the hospital for observation. The older one had to have 4 stitches, mild concussion.
Could they give a description?
The younger one did. Quiet, husky, dark mustache and hair. A wig, I think. The guard at the door said the same thing. The older woman, he could have been in a rabbit suit for all she saw.
But he didn't kill anybody.
Odd, Crawford said. He'd have been better off to wax them both. He could have been sure of his lead time leaving and saved himself a description or two. Behavioral science called Bloom in the hospital about it. You know what he said? Bloom said, maybe he's trying to stop.
Chapter 44 Dollarhide heard the flaps moan down. The lights of St. Louis wheeled slowly beneath the black wing. Under his feet, the landing gear rumbled into a rush of air and locked down with a thud. He rolled his head on his shoulders to ease the stiffness in his powerful neck. Coming home. He had taken a great risk, and the prize he brought back was the power to choose. He could choose to have Reba McLean alive. He could have her to talk to, and he could have her startling and harmless mobility in his bed. He did not have to dread his house. He had the dragon in his belly now. He could go into his house, walk up to a copy dragon on the wall, and wad him up if he wanted to. He did not have to worry about feeling love for Reba. If he felt love for her, he could toss the Shermans to the dragon and ease it that way, go back to Reba calm and easy and treat her well. From the terminal, Dollarhide telephoned her apartment. Not home yet. He tried Bader Chemical. The night line was busy. He thought of Reba walking toward the bus stop after work, tapping along with her cane, her raincoat over her shoulders. He drove to the film laboratory through the light evening traffic in less than 15 minutes. She wasn't at the bus stop. He parked on the street behind Bader Chemical, near the entrance closest to the dark rooms. He'd tell her he was here, wait until she had finished working, and drive her home. He was proud of his new power to choose. He wanted to use it. There were things he could catch up on in his office while he waited. Only a few lights were on in Bader Chemical. Reba's dark room was locked. The light above the door was neither red nor green. It was off. He pressed the buzzer. No response. Maybe she had left a message in his office. He heard footsteps in the corridor. The Bader supervisor, Dandridge, passed the dark room area and never looked up. He was walking fast and carrying a thick bundle of buff personnel files under his arm. A small crease appeared in Dollarhide's forehead. Dandridge was halfway across the parking lot, heading for the Gateway building, when Dollarhide came out of Bader behind him. 2 delivery vans and 6 cars were on the lot. That Buick belonged to Fisk, Gateway's personnel director. What were they doing? There was no night shift at Gateway. Much of the building was dark. Dollarhide could see by the red exit signs in the corridor as he went toward his office. The lights were on behind the frosted glass door of the personnel department. Dollarhide heard voices in there, Dandridge's for one, and Fisk's. A woman's footsteps coming. Fisk's secretary turned the corner into the corridor ahead of Dollarhide. She had a scarf tied over her curlers, and she carried ledgers from accounting. She was in a hurry.
The ledgers were heavy, a big armload. She pecked on Fisk's office door with her toe. Will Graham opened it for her.
Dollarhide froze in the dark hall. His gun was in his van. The office door closed again. Dollarhide moved fast, his running shoes quiet on the smooth floor. He put his face close to the glass of the exit door and scanned the parking lot. Movement now under the floodlights. A man moving. He was beside one of the delivery vans, and he had a flashlight, flicking something. He was dusting the outside mirror for fingerprints. Behind Dollarhide, somewhere in the corridors, a man was walking. Get away from the door. He ducked around the corner and down the stairs to the basement and the furnace room on the opposite side of the building. By standing on a workbench, he could reach the high windows that opened at ground level behind the shrubbery. He rolled over the sill and came up on his hands and knees in the bushes, ready to run or fight. Nothing moved on this side of the building. He stood up, put a hand in his pocket, and strolled across the street. Running when the sidewalk was dark, walking as cars went by, he made a long loop around Gateway and Bader Chemical. His van stood at the curb behind Bader. There was no place to hide close to it. All right. He sprinted across the street and leaped in, clawing at his valise. Full clip in the automatic. He jacked around into the chamber and laid the pistol on the console, covering it with a T-shirt. Slowly he drove away. Don't catch the red light. Slowly around the corner and into the scattered traffic. He had to think now, and it was hard to think. It had to be the films. Graham knew about the films somehow. Graham knew where. He didn't know who. If he knew who, he wouldn't need personnel records. Why accounting records, too? Absences, that's why. Match absences against the dates when the dragon struck. No, those were Saturdays, except for Lowndes. Absences on the days before those Saturdays, he'd look for those. Fool him there. No workman's compensation slips were kept for management. Dollarhide drove slowly up Lindbergh Boulevard, gesturing with his free hand as he ticked off the points. They were looking for fingerprints. He'd given them no chance for fingerprints, except maybe on the plastic pass at Brooklyn Museum. He'd picked it up in a hurry, mostly by the edges. They must have a print. Why fingerprint if they didn't have something to match it to? They were checking that van for prints. No time to see if they were checking cars, too. Van. Carrying the wheelchair with Lowndes in it. That tipped them. Or maybe somebody in Chicago saw the van. There were a lot of vans at Gateway. Private vans, delivery vans. No. Graham just knew he had a van. Graham knew because he knew. Graham knew. Graham knew. The son of a bitch was a monster. They'd fingerprint everyone at Gateway and Bader, too. If they didn't spot him tonight, they'd do it tomorrow. He had to run forever with his face on every bulletin board, in every post office and police station. It was all coming to pieces. He was puny and small before them. Reba, he said aloud. Reba couldn't save him now. They were closing in on him, and he was nothing but a puny hare-lip. Are you sorry now that you betrayed me? The dragon's voice rumbled from deep within him, deep as the shredded painting in his bowels. I didn't. I just wanted to choose. You called me. Give me what I want, and I'll save you. No, I'll run.
Give me what I want, and you'll hear Graham's spine snap. No. I admire what you did today. We're close now. We can be one again. Do you feel me inside you? You do, don't you?
Yes.
And you know I can save you. You know they'll send you to a place worse than Brother Buddy's. Give me what I want, and you'll be free. No. They'll kill you, the old jerk on the ground. No. When you're gone, she'll fuck other people. She'll... No. Shut up. She'll fuck other people. Pretty people. She'll put their... Stop it. Shut up. Slow down. And I won't say it.
Dollarhide's foot lifted on the accelerator.
That's good. Give me what I want, and it can't happen. Give it to me, and then I'll always let you choose. You can always choose, and you'll speak well. I want you to speak well. Slow down. That's right. See the service station? Pull over there, and let me talk to you.
Chapter 45. Graham came out of the office suite and rested his eyes for a moment in the dim hallway. He was restive, uneasy. This was taking too long. Crawford was sifting the 380 Gateway and Bader employees as fast and well as it could be done. The man was a marvel at this kind of job. But time was passing, and secrecy could be maintained only so long. Crawford had kept the working group at Gateway to a minimum. "We want to find him, not spook him," Crawford had told them. "If we can spot him tonight, we can take him outside the plant, maybe at his house or on the lot." The St. Louis Police Department was cooperating. Lieutenant Fogel of St. Louis Homicide and one sergeant came quietly in an unmarked car, bringing a datafax. Wired to a Gateway telephone, in minutes the datafax was transmitting the employment roll simultaneously to the FBI Identification Section in Washington and the Missouri Department of Motor Vehicles. In Washington, the names would be checked against both the civil and criminal fingerprint records. Names of Bader employees with security clearances were flagged for faster handling. The Department of Motor Vehicles would check for ownership of vans. Only 4 employees were brought in. The personnel manager, Fisk, Fisk's secretary, Dandridge from Bader Chemical, and Gateway's chief accountant. No telephones were used to summon the employees to this late-night meeting at the plant. Agents called at their houses and stated their business privately. "Look 'em over before you tell 'em why you want 'em," Crawford said. "And don't let 'em use the telephone after. This kind of news travels fast." They had hoped for a quick identification from the teeth. None of the 4 employees recognized them. Graham looked down the long corridors, lit with red exit signs. Damn, it felt right. What else could they do tonight? Crawford had requested that the woman from the Brooklyn Museum, Miss Harper, be flown out as soon as she could travel. Probably that would be in the morning. The St. Louis Police Department had a good surveillance van. She could sit in it and watch the employees go in. If they didn't hit it tonight, all traces of the operation would be removed from Gateway before work started in the morning. Graham didn't kid himself. They'd be lucky to have a whole day to work before the word got out at Gateway. The Dragon would be watching for anything suspicious. He would fly. Chapter 46. A late supper with Ralph Mandy had seemed all right.
Reba McLean knew she had to tell him sometime, and she didn't believe in leaving things hanging. Actually, she thought Mandy knew what was coming when she insisted on going Dutch. She told him in the car, as he took her home, that it was no big deal. She'd had a lot of fun with him and wanted to be his friend, but she was involved with somebody now. Maybe he was hurt a little, but she knew he was relieved a little, too. He was pretty good about it, she thought. At her door, he didn't ask to come in. He did ask to kiss her goodbye, and she responded gladly. He opened her door and gave her the keys. He waited until she was inside and had closed the door and locked it. When he turned around, Dollarhide shot him in the throat and twice in the chest. 3 puts from the silenced pistol. A scooter is louder. Dollarhide lifted Mandy's body easily, laid him between the shrubs and the house, and left him there. Seeing Reba kiss Mandy had stabbed Dollarhide deep. Then the pain left him for good. He still looked and sounded like Francis Dollarhide. The dragon was a very good actor. He played Dollarhide well. Reba was washing her face when she heard the doorbell. It rang 4 times before she got there. She touched the chain, but didn't take it off. "Who is it?" "Francis Dollarhide." She eased the door open, still on the chain. "Tell me again." "Dollarhide, it's me." She knew it was. She took off the chain. Reba did not like surprises. "I thought you said you'd call me, Dee." "I would have, but this is an emergency, really," he said, clapping the chloroformed cloth over her face as he stepped inside. The street was empty. Most of the houses were dark. He carried her to the van. Ralph Mandy's feet stuck out of the shrubbery into the yard. Dollarhide didn't bother with him anymore. She woke on the ride. She was on her side, her cheek in the dusty carpet of the van, transmission whine loud in her ear. She tried to bring her hands to her face. The movement mashed her bosom. Her forearms were stuck together. She felt them with her face. They were bound together from her elbows to her wrists with what felt like soft strips of cloth. Her legs were tied the same way from knees to ankles. Something was across her mouth. "What? What?" Dee was at the door, and then she remembered twisting her face away and the terrible strength of him. Oh, Lord, what was it? Dee was at the door, and then she was choking something cold, and she tried to twist her face away, but there was a terrible grip on her head. She was in Dee's van now. She recognized the resonances. The van was going. Fear ballooned in her. Her instinct said, "Be quiet," but the fumes were in her throat, chloroform and gasoline. She retched against the gag. Dee's voice. "It won't be long now." She felt a turn, and they were on gravel now, rocks pinging under the fenders and floorboard. "He's crazy." "All right, that's it. Crazy." "Crazy is a fearsome word." What was it? Ralph Mandy. He must have seen them at her house. It set him off. Christ Jesus, get it all ready. A man had tried to slap her once at Riker Institute. She was quiet, and he couldn't find her. He couldn't see either. This one could fucking well see. Get it all ready. Get ready to talk. God, he could kill me with this gag in my mouth. God, he could be killing me and not understand what I was saying. Be ready. Have it all ready, and don't say, "Huh?" Tell him he can back out. No damage. I won't tell. Be passive as long as you can. If you can't be passive, wait until you can find his eyes. The van stopped. The van rocked as he got out. Side door sliding open. grass and hot tires on the air. Crickets. He came in the van. In spite of herself, she squealed into the gag and twisted her face away from him when he touched her. Soft pats on the shoulder didn't stop her writhing. A stinging slap across the face did. She tried to talk into the gag. She was lifted, carried. His footsteps hollow on the ramp. She was sure where she was now, his house. Where in his house? Clock ticking to the right. Rug, then floor. The bedroom where they did it. She was sinking in his arms, felt the bed under her. She tried to talk into the gag. He was leaving. Noise outside, van door slammed. Here he comes, setting something on the floor, metal cans. She smelled gasoline. Reba? Dee's voice all right, but so calm, so terribly calm and strange. Reba? I don't know what to say to you. You felt so good, and you don't know what I did for you. And I was wrong, Reba. You made me weak, and then you hurt me. She tried to talk into the gag. If I untie you and let you sit up, will you be good? Don't try to run. I can catch you. Will you be good? She twisted her head toward the voice to nod. A touch of cold steel against her skin, whisper of a knife through cloth, and her arms were free. Now her legs. Her cheeks were wet where the gag came off. Carefully and slowly she sat up in the bed. Take your best shot. Dee, she said. I didn't know you cared this much about me. I'm glad you feel that way, but see, you scared me with this. No answer. She knew he was there. Dee, was it old dumb Ralph Mandy that made you mad? Did you see him at my house? That's it, isn't it? I was telling him I don't want to see him anymore, because I want to see you. I'm never going to see Ralph again. Ralph died, Dollarhide said. I don't think he liked it very much. Fantasy. He's making it up. Jesus, do I hope. I've never hurt you, Dee. I never wanted to. Let's just be friends and fuck and have a good time and forget about this. Shut up, he said calmly. I'll tell you something. The most important thing you'll ever hear. Sherman on the Mount, important. 10 Commandments, important. Got it? Yes, Dee. I shut up. Reba, some remarkable events have happened in Birmingham and Atlanta. Do you know what I'm talking about? She shook her head. It's been on the news a lot. 2 groups of people were changed. Leeds and Jacoby. The police think they were murdered. Do you know now? She started to shake her head. Then she did know, and slowly she nodded. Do you know what they call the being that visited those people? You can say. The tooth. A hand gripped her face, shutting off the sound. Think carefully and answer correctly. It's dragon something. Dragon? Red dragon. He was close to her. She could feel his breath on her face. I am the dragon. Leaping back, driven by the volume and terrible timbre of the voice, she slammed against the headboard. The dragon wants you, Reba. He always has. I didn't want to give you to him. I did a thing for you today, so he couldn't have you, and I was wrong. This was Dee. She could talk to Dee. Please, please don't let him have me. You won't? Please don't. You wouldn't. I'm for you. Keep me with you. You like me. I know you do.
I haven't made up my mind yet. Maybe I can't help giving you to him. I don't know. I'm going to see if you do as I tell you. Will you? Can I depend on you?
I'll try. I will try. Don't scare me too much or I can't.
Get up, Reba.
Stand by the bed.
Do you know where you are in the room? She nodded. You know where you are in the house, don't you? You wandered around in the house while I was asleep, didn't you?
Asleep?
Don't be stupid. When we spent the night here, you went through the house, didn't you? Did you find something odd? Did you take it and show it to somebody? Did you do that, Reba?